Greetings and welcome to the third lecture in our series on Megillat Esther. In the last lecture, we ended off with Vashti's refusal in chapter 1, verse 12. Vashti's refusal to come at the king's behest to the party in all of her finery, and the king's response was his tremendous anger. We will pick it up at this point. Now, as we pointed out, at the beginning of the Megillah and during the first two lectures, it seems quite clear that Ahasuerus has a challenge in front of him as far as strengthening his hold over the kingdom. And this becomes apparent from the fact that, first of all, it takes him into his third year before he can have his coronation party. Kishevet HaMelech Ahasuerus, he sits on his throne in the third year of his reign. And the second is the lavish parties that he throws for the officers and the financial brokers and the politicos, in effect to gain their support, their allegiance, their respect, and perhaps even their fear, culminating with a 7-day bacchanal for the citizens of Shushan. And as Chazal say in Masechet Megillah, he did that to ensure that if there were an uprising, at least the citizens of his palace city would defend him and would support him. This insecurity on Ahasuerus' part, this unwillingness to take a strong stand and be very concerned with the people's opinion of him, seems to be at play in the next few verses. In Pasuk Yod Gimel we read, Vayomer HaMelech. Now, let's take a step back and put ourselves in Ahasuerus' shoes. If Ahasuerus, and as I pointed out at the end of the last lecture, Vashti's refusal was not a private affair, but rather a very public, to use the current jargon, disrespecting of Ahasuerus in front of all of the women and in front of the 7 messengers that he sent, with whom he sent the invitation. Ahasuerus, at that point, who is very angry and is the king, and the king's fiat is law, should by rights have just acted based on his own, either if he was able to, his own thinking, or if he was unable to, based on his own emotion. And hearing that his anger seethed within him, we would fully expect him to say, off with her head, out of the kingdom, whatever it is that would come to mind. We are very surprised by his move. He speaks to the wise men who know the times. Now, midrashically, this is interpreted as a reference to the children of Yisachar, who are the ones who are experts in astronomy and know how to intercalate the calendar and to calculate the movement of the heavenly spheres. But the simple read of this is Yodei Ha'itim, the people who know the times, means the court historians. So he called the sages who are the court historians. Now, why is he calling historians as opposed to people who are experts on domestic policy or foreign policy or relations with the provinces? For a simple reason, as we read, Kichein Devar HaMelech Lifnei Kol Yodei Dat Vadin. For these are the words of the king, this is the matters of the king, in the presence of anyone who knows Dat Vadin. Now, the word Dat, as I explained last time, is a Persian word that in its original meaning means protocol or custom. It comes into Hebrew via the Megillah and only during Second Temple period times, when Persian influence becomes very great on the language in addition to on the culture and other things. And the word dat by the times of medieval Hebrew takes on a different meaning, which is more associated with theology, and in modern times takes on the meaning of religion in the sense of practice. But in its original meaning, it means protocol. And so the king would always call together those who know dat vadin, the protocol and the law. In other words, he's calling together the historians to ask them to check the record books to see what is the protocol in such a case when the queen publicly disrespects the emperor. What is to be done? And now we're given a list of the court officials who are his Yodei Dat Vadin, the knowers and the holders of the protocol. Vakarov elav uarde karshana shetar admata tashish meras marsana mimuchan. Among them is mentioned Mimuchan, and I'll comment on Mimuchan in a moment. Shivat Sarei Parasumadai, these are seven of the princes of Parasumadai. And this takes us back to a period which was during much of the Persian Empire, where the Medes and the Persians continued to work together, as they had in their revolution overthrowing the Babylonians. And there was a coalition of Medes and Persians, which are two different nations, sitting together in the cabinet of the emperor. Ro'ei Pnei HaMelech. Now that phrase is very important because it takes us back to the protocol of the court. But for right now, we'll just translate it. At the end of the pasuk, we'll comment on several of these terms. Ro'ei Pnei HaMelech, the ones who see the face of the king. Hayoshvim Rishona B'Malchut, who sit at the first place in the palace or in the court. What that means is these are seven of the king's most trusted and inner advisors who see the face of the king. Now, what does this phrase mean? Well, for many of us, growing up with the story of Esther as a favorite piece of our culture and our history and our awareness, we often pictured the feast of Ahasuerus and many of the later feasts that take place in the manner that we would picture a fancy banquet or a wedding in our day, with the guest of honor and the host all seated on the dais for everyone to see. And in the same way, we picture everyone coming to Ahasuerus' feast and everyone looking at Ahasuerus and perhaps raising a glass and a toast to him, whatever it may be. But that was not the case. Kings of old, in many situations, and certainly in the Persian Empire, were not to be seen by others. They were held in seclusion. And there were only certain members of the court who even had the right to see the face of the king. This played partially into the deification of the king, which is a common motif in the ancient world, and partially protection for the king. In any case, we read here that these seven ministers were among those select few who saw the face of the king. By the way, that word plays into associates itself with a word that shows up many times in Megillat Esther. We talked about last time, and those are the sarisim, which in rabbinic Hebrew and since then in medieval and modern Hebrew, the word saris means a eunuch. And the reason for that is, again, because many of the people associated with the court who would work in the women's quarter would be castrated in order to be able to do so. But the word saris doesn't mean that originally. It also is associated with shel rosh, those who see the king or who serve the king directly. In any case, Memuchan brings up an interesting rabbinic association or midrashic association, which I'll just mention sketchily now and we'll get back to in a couple of verses. The rabbis comment on Memuchan and say Memuchan ze Haman. Memuchan is Haman. And as some of the commentators on the biblical commentators on the text of Esther point out, it's very difficult to read that as in a straightforward way, a pshat way, to say Memuchan is Haman. For several reasons. One of the reasons is because either his name is Haman or his name is Memuchan. Even after Haman goes through his meteoric rise to power and then his very swift descent until he's raised on the gallows, his name doesn't change. He has different epithets. He's Tzorer HaYudim. He is Hagagi. But he's always Haman. So why here would he be introduced with a very different name? And why would the text not link them together? After all, the text will do that for us in chapter 2 when it says Hadassah, he Esther, and it tells us that Esther and Hadassah are the same person. The second problem is that in chapter 3, when Haman rises to power, which is a good 9 years after this event, the way that he's presented to us is evidently somebody who comes pretty much out of nowhere and rises to great power. And if Memuchan is already in the third year of the king, one of the inner circle, then his rise is not so meteoric as perhaps a select promotion of one of the inner circle above the rest. But the rabbis are saying something of great profundity when they suggest that Memuchan Zehaman. This takes us to, and this is a brief aside, but a very important one. This takes us to a passage in Masechet Rosh Hashanah, in Babylonian Talmud Rosh Hashanah, Daf Gimel Amud Aleph, page 3a, in which, in two instances, the rabbis identify three different characters in the Bible as being this one and the same. In one case, they identify Sihon and Melech Arad and Melech Canaan as being one and the same. And they say he's called Arad because of the way he behaves. He's called Canaan because of the name of his kingdom. His first name is Sichon, or perhaps his first name is Arad, and Sichon is because of the way he behaves, or what he looks like, or whatever it may be. And then they do the same thing with the three Persian kings, and this is part of what we talked about over the last two lectures, tangentially, about Seder Olam and rabbinic chronology, is that Koresh, Daryavesh, and Artaxasta and are all the same king, and that they, who Koresh, who Daryavesh, who Artaxasta, which is chronologically and textually very difficult to accept. And indeed, some of the Rishonim, notably the Reb Zrachi Alevi, 12th century Provence, in his commentary Sefer HaMaor, says that this cannot be accepted as a straightforward read of the text, that they are the same person, because indeed they are presented in the text as one who follows the other and who have different policies, etc. One of my teachers suggested, and I think it's a very sound suggestion, that whenever the rabbis say X, who, Y, who, Z, in other words, one person who we know to be a unique person, is the same as another person who is a separate and different unique person, that what they mean to say is that even though they are different people, and even though their policies, their behavior, etc., may seem to portray a very different attitude towards God, towards the Jewish people, towards justice, etc., indeed, when you cut to rock bottom, they're all the same. And that's what they mean by that. The reason that's significant here is that when the rabbis say Memuchan ze Haman, that Memuchan is Haman, and why is he called Memuchan? Because he's Muchan the Puranut, and Hedyot Kofetz the Rosh, and all of the comments that they make about this one being especially ready for punishment, as is Haman, etc. Indeed, what I believe that they're saying is that if you want to properly understand Haman, and Haman's successful hold over the king, which when we get to Haman himself in chapter 3, we will see how very powerful and somewhat mysterious and enigmatic his hold is. If you want to understand that, start by looking at Memuchan, because they have the same abilities, they have something of the same traits. And that we will see in a couple of verses. And at that point, I'll briefly sketch out how it associates with Haman. When we get to chapter 3, I'll explicate it further. In any case, he calls these advisors together. For what purpose? Kedat mala asot. Again, that word dat. He wants to know what is the protocol that should be done. Bam malka Vashti. So what should be done to the queen Vashti? Al asher lo astat mamar hamelech Achashverosh. What is the concern that we have to deal with, and we have to see what the proper protocol is? That she did not fulfill the word of the king. And if the verse stopped there, I would question, what is it that the king is concerned about? Is he concerned with the public shaming or with the refusal to fulfill his words? But the last two words in the verse give away the hand. Biyad hasarisim. What the king was concerned about was the fact that the queen refused to fulfill the bidding of the king that was delivered by his messengers, by his ministers. In other words, it was the public disrespecting of the king, the public refusal to accede to the request of the king or the demand of the king that then raised this, if you will, constitutional crisis, and then called for a response to which these advisors were summoned. So now let's see how they respond. Now, a brief introduction here, and again, it's the issue because Memuchan, who is listed last among the advisors, is the one to speak. And as we all know, his advice is taken and accepted and fulfilled and implemented, etc. We have to take into account the following conundrum, or the following quandary, really, that all of these advisors are caught in. Let's take a moment here and think. The king is enraged. The king is enraged because of the shaming, of the public shaming that Vashti caused him. But think on a much more long-range level. The king has invested 6 months and a week in this huge, lavish series of parties to evoke the respect and perhaps the fear of all of the members of his closest circles, his military and financial and political circles. And at the very climax of this, he is disrespected in a way that perhaps will undercut everything he's worked for. So you, as a member of the cabinet now, called for in for this advice, are caught in a very difficult situation. Because if you respond by saying, off with her head, exile her, whatever it may be, especially if it's off with her head, which is irretrievable, then the next day or the next week, when people start muttering about, oh, this king, he's so weak, his wife embarrassed him and he lashed out at her without any sense of temper and of moderation and of consideration, then the king is going to turn to you and say, why did you give me such terrible advice? Look what's happened. And, of course, that your head may follow hers. Another piece of the puzzle is that everybody wants to feel noble. And when somebody in what we may generously here call a childish kind of tantrum demands something, and in the end, when they wake up from it, they're going to feel kind of childish and bad about the way that they acted out. So if you insist that or advise that something rash be done to the queen, it could be that the next day or the next week or even a month later, the king will then take a more sober view of the events, and then, of course, will blame you because he's not going to blame himself. That's why he has advisors. If, on the other hand, you recommend caution, then it could be that this shaming will really have a deleterious effect and that the king's honor and respect will be diminished as a result, and you'll be the one to blame. So what do you advise the king? There is no easy way out. You can't say wait. You can't say act now. You can't say act extremely. You can't say act moderately. Whatever you say has a potential, and a very strong potential, for a boomerang effect back on you in a way that is not pleasant. So Memuchan brilliantly comes up with a piece of advice that is sure to win. And that is as follows. Everybody has a great need. And by the way, parenthetically, and it's something that's going to come up and I will mention it a number of times in Megillat Esther, to understand Megillat Esther properly, I mentioned before, you have to understand the history of the times, the background, the political background, where Am Yisrael is, etc. There's another piece, even for someone reading it out of context, reading it as a modular book, a basic understanding of human psychology is absolutely necessary to understand Megillat Esther. How people work, what people's desires are, what people's fears are, how to play upon those fears, etc., is a critical piece, and as we will discover, it is a piece of wisdom that Esther utilizes in order to save the Jewish people. Memuchan understands that everyone has a great need to feel noble, and nobility is seen in acting not for yourself, but for others, and especially when the others are not just one or two others, but for a great many people. So Memuchan comes up with the following piece of advice. If he tells Ahasuerush, let it go, we have the problem that we may face. If, on the other hand, he says, she insulted you, off with her head, again, Ahasuerush may turn around a week later or a day later and say, boy, I feel childish for acting out my rage, and I'll take it out on the fellow who advised me. So Memuchan suggests something a little bit more subtle, which is, act out how you feel, but, of course, don't do it for that reason. Do it for a noble reason. So Memuchan stands up in front of the king and in front of his colleagues. And he says, Lo al hamelech levado av tavashti hamalka. It is not only against the king himself that she has sinned. Ki al kol hasarim v'al kol hamim. She has sinned against all of the ministers and all of the nations, meaning all of the leaders or the men of the nations. Asher b'chom adinot ha-melech Ahasuerush, that are in all of the provinces of the king, meaning throughout the Persian kingdom. Vashti has sinned against all of the men of the kingdom. Why? Ki etzei dvar malkal kol anashim lavzot ba'alehen b'enehen. When her word goes out, when the word of what she did goes out to the kingdom, all of the women will disrespect their husbands in their own eyes. Why? B'omram, because what are they going to say? Ha-melech Ahasuerush amar laviyat vashti ha-malkal afanah v'lo va'a. After all, the king Ahasuerush told his wife to come, and she refused. Vayom hazeh, what's going to happen as a result? Tomarna sarot parasumadai, the wives of the ministers of parasumadai, asher shamu advar malka, who heard the queen's words, or what the queen did, the chol sarei hamelech, that's what they're going to say to their husbands, uchdai bizayon vakatzef, there will be much disrespectfulness, disrespecting, and disgrace, and much anger. In other words, here's what's going to happen. The ministers are, first of all, the ministers have collected their wives, and their wives who were at the end of the party saw this disrespecting happen. And so the ministers who are impressed with the king's lavish palace and perhaps are even in awe of him, on the way home, their wives will likely tell them what happened and your own respect will be demeaned. But that's on one level. The second thing is, when the word spreads, the minister is going to come home and tell his wife to dress up for a fancy party or to get his dinner ready or whatever, and she will refuse, and she'll say, after all, Vashti refused to do what Ahasuerus said, I'm not going to do what you said. And what's going to happen is that you're going to, that there will be a generation of tremendous friction within the homes, and as a result of that, within these provinces, and it will all be on account of Vashti's behavior. And so she has really sinned against all the men, and it is your job, Ahasuerus, to stand up for the pride and the honor of all of the men, especially the ministers, which of course strikes a responsive chord for Ahasuerus, because those are the people whose respect he was trying to cultivate over the past 6 months, at least, if not 3 years, and if not even before that, before he was emperor. So what will happen? Imal ha'melach tov, if the king is agreeable, so there should be an edict that goes out. Which means, by the way, remember, there has not yet been a case in the annals of when a queen publicly disrespected the king. So we have to create new law. It should be written into the protocols of Persia and Media, and it should, veloyavor means it cannot be canceled. It cannot be annulled, just like every protocol. What is this important protocol? And again, we've seen, the first dot that we read about in this kingdom was the rules about how to drink. Now we're going to have a very important ruling. Asher lo tavo Vashti lifnei ha-melech Ahasuerosh. What's the ruling? That Vashti will no longer come before the king Ahasuerosh. And by the way, we do not know what happens to her. We just know she's no longer queen. She could be exiled, she could be killed, she could be cleaning toilets, she could be in the harem. We don't know. We know she's no longer queen. Umalchuta yitein ha-melech. And her crown or her throne will be given to her fellow, as it were, her friend or better, who is better than she. In other words, it will be written in the annals that the queen Vashti, who publicly disrespected the king, as a consequence of that action, lost her throne and her crown was given to a better woman. That is what Memuchan advises. Memuchan knows how to get what he wants and how to act in what really is the best interest of the crown, perhaps, but how to do it in a way that Ahasuerus will not feel childish or low about acting that way, but rather will feel noble and protector, as it were, of the realm. And then, Memuchan continues, the word will go out. Pitgam is another Persian word that comes into Hebrew through here. Here in Kohelet, several other books, Nishma Pitgam HaMelech Asher Yaseh B'chol Malchuto, this word will go out, that what the king does will be spread out throughout the kingdom, Ki Rabahi. In other words, it will have to be spread out, it will have to be promulgated throughout the kingdom and publicized, because it's a large kingdom. B'chol HaNashim Yitnu L'Kar L'Valehen, what will happen? All the women will give great honor to their husbands, because they'll be afraid, because you'll make an example out of Vashti. Which means even some relatively minor fellow will have his wife in awe of him. That is Muhan's advice. What is the result? Everybody liked this advice, the king and the ministers. The king did what Muhan said. Now, there are several components to this that we have to think about. On the one hand, the king is, as I mentioned last time, demonstrating classic, what we might call passive-aggressive behavior. He refuses to take any responsibility for his decisions. He asks other people's advice. They give him their advice, and he agrees, which means later on, and we'll see this in the beginning of the next lecture when we start chapter 2, when the king is perhaps unhappy or perhaps discouraged about what happened, it's not something he did. It's something that was done to Vashti. It's something that other people suggested. The second thing, though, to take into account is that this is the emperor of the empire ruling the known world. And really, who's pulling the strings? One of his advisors. And that becomes an important motif throughout the Megillah, how we find that for a while Haman seems to be running the kingdom, And then for a while, Mordechai seems to be running the kingdom. And then for a while, Esther seems to be running the kingdom. The one person who's not in charge of the kingdom at any point is the king, the emperor. Something to take into account when understanding the way that the Tanakh is describing the Persian court. I'm not even concerned with how accurate it is to what the Persian court really looked like, just not like I'm not concerned with how accurate a portrayal of the historic Ahasuerus, or how complete of a portrayal of Ahasuerus I have in the text, because I'm much more concerned with what the Megillah is trying to communicate about the Persian court and about human monarchy than I am about a specific historic record. Not to say that there's anything in the historic record that is not accurate, but it is not complete. We're not told about what Ahasuerus did, for instance, during the first 3 years. We're also not told about what Ahasuerus did between year 7, when he crowns Esther, and year 12, when Haman rises to power. That all happens in a flash in the Megillah. But Ahasuerus certainly did other things. And the historic Ahasuerus that we know of fought valiant battles and had great victories. So there's many pieces of Ahasuerus that we're not given here, because that's not the point of the Megillah. The point of the Megillah is to tell a particular story, and along the way to give us a particular picture and a set of attitudes and values towards the Persian court specifically, and perhaps towards human monarchy in general, especially foreign monarchy and Jews' rule under that. In any case, the end of the chapter goes as follows. Now we have to understand that there are 127 provinces in the Persian kingdom. And as we've already gotten a sense of, and we are going to see it now explicitly in this verse, the Persians did not have the same attitude as other conquering countries, where they insisted that everyone in the kingdom speak the official language, that everyone read the official script, follow the official customs, follow the official religion, etc. As I mentioned in the first lecture, Persians were quite benevolent and, in a sense, very progressive in this way, where they allowed each country to develop its own natural indigenous culture and religion, etc., as long as they didn't rebel and they paid taxes. Which meant that any communication that went forth from Babel and later Elam and now Shushan, in other words, the Persian court, had to be sent out in many different languages, in many different scripts, taken by people who could read to the people that they were bringing it to, because in many cases they'd be bringing it to communities that were perhaps illiterate. And this required an entire enterprise of scribes and translators working at a fevered pitch, you would assume, when such an edict had to go out. So when the text says, when the scrolls or the texts were sent out throughout the kingdom, provinces of the king, it says it in a couple words, but remember, we're talking about a huge undertaking. To every nation, or to every political jurisdiction in its own script, and to every nation in its own language. And what was this big thing? So you got to imagine, you are a citizen of one of the outlying provinces, and you see a horseman come up with the royal crest of the king around the horse's neck, and he comes up to the town square, and everybody gathers together, and you all know what's happening. It's either going to be another tax or another war. That's pretty much what you would expect. And the fellow gets off of the horse, and he says, hear ye, by order of, and he doesn't say Ahasuerus, by order of, the king of kings, protector of the realm, etc., with all of the honorifics. And you're sitting there waiting, okay, go ahead, what's the news? And what's the news? L'yot kol ish sorer beveito, the end of the verse, that every man rules in his house, and speaks his own language, effectively saying that the king's rule, the king's edict is that every man is the king in his own castle and speaks the language of his nation, which seems to mean that if a man marries a woman from a different nation, he can enforce that the language spoken in the house is the language of his own nation. Well, a piece of this, as Chazal pick up on Masechet Megillah and Midrashei Esther, is almost setting up the rest of the story to crumble in on itself. Because it now means that when edicts are sent out from the court, people will look with something of a jaundiced eye and say, the last edict that came out was silly. I mean, for someone to send out an edict throughout the kingdom that says every man rules in his own house, as I'll say, even a relatively insignificant guy knows that he's the king of his own castle. Now, whatever contemporary ears may do with such a message, we have to be honest that in the ancient world that was certainly the case. And so for the king to send something out which seems to be really very much of a facade against what has happened in his own court, that his own queen has challenged his hegemony over the house, makes him, if you will, somewhat of a laughingstock in the eyes of the people. And indeed, Chazal say that if il malei igarot rishonot, if it were not for these first letters that went out, lo nishtar mitzonayim shel Yisrael, sayidu palit, not one Jew would have been left alive in the world. Why? Because then the later letters that went out that said that the people have the right to go kill the Jews, they would have acted on it immediately. But now they said, you know what, the king sends out strange messages, as is evidenced by this story and by this message. We're going to wait and see what happens. And by the time that wait and see period ended, of course, the entire story had been turned up and down, upside down in the famous motif of the Megillah, which is V'nehafochu. Everyone should have a wonderful day, and Amir Tz Hashem, on Thursday, we will pick up at the beginning of chapter 2.